This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, is slave labour being used to build Victoria's new trains? And a change for the better, how regeneration can improve the lives of those living in housing estates.
The houses have fallen apart and I think the way they've changed it now has, it's more respectable, where people were, the stigma sort of, like, it's changed a lot.
First up today, it's a story that's captured the sympathy of many Australians from across the political divide. Despite pressure from some of its own members, the government won't budge on the long-term future of a Sri Lankan Tamil family. After 3 years in detention centres, the Murrahuppin family will now be allowed to live in community detention in Perth, but the family still faces the prospect of deportation back to Sri Lanka. Rachel Mealy joins me now. Rachel, good afternoon. What does the Immigration Minister's decision mean for the family?
Well, Sally, it simply means a move. The minister has changed their current address. They'll now move to live in Perth in community detention, and they'll be able to stay there while their ongoing legal appeals against deportation continue. But at this stage, we don't know how long that's going to be. Now, just for some background, the parents in the family came from Sri Lanka to Australia by boat in 2013, and they lived in Bilawila while they waited for their asylum claims to be heard. When the asylum claim was rejected in 2018, the federal government made moves to deport them, but lawyers for the family asked the courts to intervene. Now, since then, they've been in immigration detention centres on Christmas Island and Melbourne for 3 years, and when the younger daughter, Tanika, became sick last week, she was flown to hospital in Perth. The Immigration Minister, Alex Hawke, says this isn't a long-term solution.
So nothing today has given them any pathway to a permanent visa. You have to remember that they have litigated over several years their protection claims. It's been through the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, the Federal Court, the Federal Circuit Court, the full Federal Court and the High Court. And none of those judicial or administrative processes has found that we owe them protection.
That's the Minister, Alex Hawker. And Rachel, what's behind this decision?
Well, the short answer is politics. It's a sitting week this week in Canberra, and the federal government, as you said, has been under enormous pressure to make a decision about this family's future. That pressure has come from all fronts. The opposition, which wants the family to be allowed to return to Bilawila, but also crucially, this family's plight has been getting to ordinary Australians. Whatever their political persuasions, people have been saying, we have to do something to solve this. And when you get community pressure, the backbenchers feel it, and they've been agitating for change behind the scenes. But interestingly, the Immigration Minister, in his round of interviews this morning, has been using very hardline language about the family, as we just heard there. He says they aren't true refugees and they should be sent back to Sri Lanka if they don't meet that criteria. He did say in his statement today that he will consider at a future date whether to lift the bar on members of the family reapplying for temporary protection visas. But the pressure is still on for a more permanent solution. And here's an interesting comment made this morning by the National Party member Ken O'Dowd, whose seat takes in the town of Bilawila. He says he's spoken to the Immigration Minister, and he says another decision about the future of the family is imminent. Ken O'Dowd spoke to ABC Capricornia.
I think so, Paul. I think it'll be done in probably the next 24 hours, if not in the next 12 hours. It's an issue that won't go away without some, you know, permanent, you know, resolution being made to the whole issue. With nearly 1,200 days in detention, it's got to come to an end for the family's sake and for, you know, everyone else's.
And Rachel, what's been the public response to this decision so far?
Well, the friends and supporters of the family have welcomed the decision, and they're just glad they can put the Christmas Island detention centre behind them. They're also saying it's a good thing that the family will be reunited in Perth later today, with the father and the older daughter reuniting with Priya and Tanika. But they also say that a long-term decision is still needed. The family's lawyer, Karina Ford, has asked the Immigration Minister to review the case in its entirety, and she sent him materials relating to the mental health of the two children. She's worried that the Immigration Minister has made a hasty circuit breaker decision here without reviewing all the material in front of him.
But I would hope that all the information that we have put forward gets properly considered and not based on political rhetoric. And that's what worries me, is that, you know, we were told it was going to take 2 weeks for the minister to read through all the information, and now it appears that the information is hardly even being considered, you know, and that is a concern.
That's Karina Ford. And before that, our reporter in Brisbane, Rachel Mealy. So what are the legal implications of the government's decision for the Muruhappan family? Greg Barnes SC is spokesman for the Australian Lawyers Alliance. I spoke to him a short time ago.
Well, I think, you know, the initial reaction of most lawyers would be that some humanity has at last been shown in this case. But I think that the real issue is that the minister has not been prepared to what they call lift the bar under the Migration Act and to grant a visa to this family, so that they have to continue their battles in the courts and they are in community detention. So, in other words, they're not free to go about their lives. They still have extraordinary stress in their life.
So how many more legal battles would they still have ahead of them?
Well, look, they've got a matter in the federal court, and depending on the result of that, there may be further appeals by the Commonwealth or by the family. What the minister could have done, and he explicitly ruled it out, was simply say, look, this case has gone on long enough, this family has suffered enough, and simply given them visas so that they could remain in Australia. That hasn't been done, and that really is disappointing, because that is available to the minister and could have been exercised. And this is clearly a case where full compassion is required.
What do you think about the argument that it may attract other people to try their luck coming to Australia?
Look, I think that's nonsensical. If you look at the statistics each year, ministers exercise their discretion to grant visas to people in exceptional circumstances. It's not a serious proposition that I think anyone would put. And of course, it's undermined. The government's own rhetoric on this has been undermined by virtue of the fact that they've been prepared to let this family move from detention to Perth.
So, Greg, what are the usual conditions with this in terms of community detention? For example, while this family is to reside in Perth, could they travel elsewhere to visit? Could they visit Bilawila?
Well, I don't think there are any restrictions on travel within Australia in that sense. Certainly people on community detention that I've known have been able to travel. They do have to have an address, and again, they regularly check in with immigration. There are restrictions too on access to healthcare, restrictions on access to employment. That's why you get a lot of agencies such as Red Cross and others who work with these families.
Just in a straight-up legal sense, though, this family, on several occasions, they have not been found to be deserving of protection in Australia, though. Is that right? So in terms of following the law, that the government doesn't owe them protection. Is that correct?
Well, that's as I understand the position to date. But the argument now is whether or not an application for a visa by the youngest child is valid. And secondly, at the end of the day, the Migration Act really allows ministers to play God with people's lives. They have enormous discretion, and that discretion can be used to grant people visas when they don't fit within one of the categories. That's the idea. And so it's been done before. It can be done again. So when you say it's as a matter of law, the government is acting within the law, yes, in one sense, that might be right. But, you know, given that this is a discretionary power, it does mean that the government could grant a visa and still be acting within the law, and some would say probably within the spirit of the law.
That's Greg Barnes SC, spokesman for the Australian Lawyers Alliance. Well, Australia and the United Kingdom have reached an in-principle agreement on a free trade deal. Prime Ministers Scott Morrison and Boris Johnson met overnight in London to work through outstanding issues in the long-running negotiations. Political reporter Jade McMillan joined me earlier in Canberra. Jade, good afternoon. What do we know about this detail of the deal so far?
Look, not a lot at this stage. We've been told that an in-principle agreement has been reached, so this is not the final deal, but it is a significant step forward. The main areas of negotiations so far have centred around Australian agricultural exports, with some British farmers worried about the impact that that could have on their livelihoods, as well as Australia's existing requirement that British backpackers have to spend a certain amount of time working in agriculture here if they they want to extend their stay. At this stage, neither side is releasing the detail of what they've agreed to on either issue, but the Australian Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, has released a statement saying that this agreement is a win for jobs and businesses and that it highlights what two liberal democracies can achieve when they work together. While his predecessor and now Finance Minister, Simon Birmingham, spoke to RN Breakfast ahead of the announcement that an in-principle agreement had been reached, and he spoke about the opportunities that it's hoped this deal will create.
Australia had had a very significant market into the United Kingdom prior to their entry into the European Common Market some four decades or so ago. The changed arrangements there that saw the UK put in place high tariffs and quotas as part of the arrangements from Europe then eroded over a long period of time Australia's position in the UK market. If we can get back to an era or a position where we have substantial elimination of tariffs and quotas for Australian goods, as well as an opening up of services markets, then it does provide access to a very significant, very high-value market in the UK.
That's the Finance Minister, Simon Birmingham. And Jade, when are we expecting to learn some more?
Well, Prime Ministers Morrison and Johnson met for several hours over a working dinner last night, London time, and they're expected to meet again over breakfast before making a formal announcement. That's expected to be early evening, Australian Eastern Standard Time. So there is still a lot more detail to be revealed. And again, this is only an in-principle agreement, but it is significant for both sides, particularly for the UK, considering this will be its first major post-Brexit trade agreement.
That's our political reporter, Jade McMillan. Well, there's deep concern in Australia about poverty and inequality. We're focusing on southwest Sydney, the site of some of Australia's most marginalised communities. Public housing estates there have been demolished to be replaced by what's known as salt and pepper style of development, where 30% of homes are social housing and the rest are privately owned. Yesterday, we heard from some of the residents of the suburb of Claymore. Today, in the second part of our three-part series, our reporter Lexi Metherall looks at what happens to the residents of former housing estates when they're overhauled.
Oh, hello. How are you going, Karen?
Karen Smutter has lived in Minto in southwest Sydney since she was 21. She came here with her oldest son, Frank, when he was just five. The 52-year-old now lives there with two of her grandsons, who she's a kinship carer for, and her three chihuahuas.
Come in. It's Chopper, Gemma and Gandhi.
I like Minto. I'm very social. Got a lot of friends here and friends that have moved, but I've made new friends with new people that have moved in as well, so, yeah.
Until 2007, Minto was a public housing estate, but it was then progressively demolished and rebuilt.
Oh, a lot of people were scared of where they're going to end up. It was sort of exciting but scary too, because people had been in the same place for a long time and everybody got to know each other and become really good friends, but they didn't know what to expect.
Do you feel like the redevelopment needed to happen in Minto?
I mean, yes, the houses were falling apart, yes. And I think the way they've changed it now has, it's more respectable, where people were stigma, you know what I mean? The stigma sort of, like, it's changed a lot.
Minto became a mixed tenure suburb, with most of the new homes privately owned and the remainder public housing. School teacher Mohammed Karadi and his wife bought in Minto to be closer to their work in 2008, while the redevelopment was in its early stages. And he says it's transformed the place.
The vibe overall is very positive and people want to move in there. And the shopping centre is thriving. It's really buzzing. Every time you can't even find parking now. When I used to go to the shopping, I used to keep looking at, you know, because it was deserted. Like, it was really kind of, it felt like haunted.
The Land and Housing Corporation, which did the redevelopment, aims to make the public housing indistinguishable from the private homes. Mohammed agrees with Karen. The stigma of Minto has gone.
This stigma was taken off that the Minto is known for housing commission is gone. The market value of the house has gone up.
Housing authorities have been undertaking programs of renewing their public housing stock across the country for some time. It's partly a drive to reduce concentrations of people living with disadvantage. The New South Wales Housing Minister, Melinda Pavey.
When you see kids at school learning and thriving and other, you know, it's just so good. We had NAPLAN scores go off the Richter scale at Minto. You changed a suburb and you changed lives.
Policymakers claim urban renewal creates social mix, where private homeowners become role models to possibly unemployed public housing residents. But Associate Professor Cathy Arthurson from Flinders University says that's not supported by the evidence.
The whole idea of the social mix kind of thesis is that there's going to be a lot of interaction between, you know, the new private neighbours and the public housing tenants. And the evidence is not actually there for that. It seems that it doesn't really happen. The people who come into the area, they live a very different lifestyle to a lot of the public housing tenants. They often go out of the area to work. You know, there's just very little evidence that people are actually getting the social interaction that's supposed to lead to the great benefits of social mix.
The housing estate of Claymore, not far from Minto, is now in the throes of being renewed. Yvonne Moss has lived there for almost 40 years, raising her four daughters on her own and forming enduring friendships.
When we all first moved in, it was young couples with, you know, two or three kids, low income. Everybody congregated together and we liked where we were at the time. Parts of Claymore were bad. You know, there's no denying it. But then you get bad in every area.
Yvonne was relocated for 9 years while her old place was demolished and the new one rebuilt. And she and her neighbours love their new units, which are designed for seniors.
So when it was first announced that they were doing this urban renewal project in Claymore, did you see the need for it?
Not really. No, I was quite happy because we moved there brand new and we had our own little group. You know, you sort of settle and you have your own friends and your own little neighbourhood. But I'm actually quite glad now that we have come back to units that really are purpose-built.
Karen from Minto is watching Claymore as the redevelopment takes place. It's where her son Frank now lives. She thinks the change will improve Claymore residents' lives.
Their esteems are so low, I think, once they move, and I feel like it gives you more confidence and more pride in yourself because, you know, you're not in that misery-looking area, miserable-looking area. So, I think it's going to be a great thing.
That report there from our journalist Lexi Metherall. And tomorrow, in the final of the three-part series on public housing, we'll examine how the demolition of public housing estates is also being driven by housing authorities' stressed budgets and whether the system is broken. Well, to Victoria now, where the state government is accused of covering up the possibility that it's buying train parts made by slave Uyghur labour. The opposition has obtained documents which show the government was advised by bureaucrats to accept the assurances of a Chinese state-owned company that forced labour wasn't being used or risk the cost of blowouts on a rail project. From Melbourne, Samantha Donovan reports.
More than 60 new trains for Victoria are being built in China. One of the component suppliers is Chinese state-owned company KTK Group. After a report from ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, found the company may be using forced Uyghur labour, the Victorian opposition made a Freedom of Information application to find out what the government knew of the claim. The opposition's transport infrastructure spokesman, David Davis, says the government's dismissal of the allegations is outrageous.
The damaging documents show that there was no independent investigation into the supply chain for Victorian rail purchases. In fact, the documents show there's every reason to suspect that many purchasers have input components that don't bear scrutiny. It's clear that Labor and the transport officers have chosen to rely on bland assurances from the train firms themselves.
La Trobe University Professor James Leibold is a senior fellow at ASPI. He's concerned the Victorian government hasn't properly investigated the claims it may be buying train parts made by slave Uyghur labour.
The documents, in particular the letter from KTK Group, makes it quite clear that the company was involved in the Xinjiang Aid Project, which is one of the key enabling mechanisms of the repressive policies in Xinjiang. They also admit that they were involved in the transfer of 78 minority workers from Nika County in Xinjiang to KTK's factories in China. So in our 2020 report, Uyghurs for Sale, we put forward a range of evidence suggesting that these labor transfer programs might be indicative of forced labor. And so these are pretty serious allegations that I believe the companies involved, as well as the Victorian government, need to conduct an independent investigation into.
How difficult is it, though, for Australian governments and companies to undertake that independent assessment, given the lack of transparency in China?
It is difficult, but at the same time, companies do have some pressure that they can bring to bear to probe this issue further.
How likely is it, do you think, that these new trains for Victoria are going to have parts in them that were made by slave Uyghur labour?
It's possible. It can't be ruled out based on what we know. And that's concerning for me, and I think concerning for a lot of other Australians.
A written statement from a Victorian government spokeswoman says that complying with modern slavery laws is non-negotiable, and the government expects everyone working with it, be it suppliers, contractors or other agencies, to adhere to them. It says all contractors working on this program have provided the Department of Transport with written assurances that forced labour wasn't used in the making of parts for the trains. The statement says the Victorian government has taken extensive steps to investigate these allegations since they were raised last year, including repeatedly seeking assurances from suppliers that forced labour isn't used in the production of Melbourne's high-capacity metro trains.
That's Samantha Donovan reporting. And finally today, almost half of adults with a disability have experienced violence, while women with a disability are more likely to be subjected to domestic violence than other women. Despite these figures, the lack of accessible and inclusive services makes escaping violence extremely difficult. Eliza Hull reports.
Tasmanian Aboriginal woman Fiona Hamilton lives with autism. She's also a survivor of domestic violence. When trying to escape her situation, she discovered just how hard it is to access proper help.
Accessibility is not just about kind of, you know, whether somebody can actually physically access your service. It's about asking people what access needs are required.
Due to living with autism, Miss Hamilton often felt she couldn't understand what was being said when she reached out for support.
Quite often I just found myself kind of dissociating, both for the trauma that I'd experienced, but also just because I just couldn't take any more information in or any more talking in. And I was continually being asked to tell my story over and over and over again to different service providers.
What do you think could have been done by domestic violence service providers to enable more inclusion for you?
So there was even some really simple things like having some visual instructions put up around, you know, how to operate particular things. You know, I was having pamphlets shoved at me by services. But at that time, there was actually no way I was even able to kind of read them.
And advocates agree, people with disabilities shouldn't have to navigate the system alone. Jen Hargrave is a researcher with the Disability Health Unit at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health.
If a woman with a disability, say she's got a cognitive impairment or a mental health issue, discloses violence, she might not be believed. If a woman with a speech impairment discloses violence, no one might stop for a minute to listen to what she's saying.
Another barrier within the domestic violence sector is a lack of understanding of the types of violence that people with disability experience. Heidi LaPaglia is the Senior Policy Officer for Women with Disabilities Australia.
So, for example, definitions of domestic and family violence often very much focus on intimate partner violence in the home, and that can come at the exclusion of things like violence from carers and support workers.
The recent federal budget announced a new National Women's Alliance will be formed to include women with disability in the prevention of violence.
We think it's a really good start and something that we haven't seen before in a federal budget, so it's definitely warmly welcome from Women with Disabilities Australia.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Minister for Families and Social Services, Anne Rustin, says that in response to the Disability Royal Commission, the federal government has committed $9.3 million to develop resources that aim to reduce violence against women and girls with disability.
That's Eliza Hull reporting. That's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. I'm Sally Sarah. Take care.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley and I'm from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Australia's trade war with China is an instructive tale, and at the G7 meeting in Cornwall this week, it was again front of mind. So what are the key lessons that the world is taking from the dispute, and why, after months of trade fights with China, has one key commodity been so far quarantined? Join me as I sit down with the host of new ABC podcast, China If You're Listening, to find out. Look for The Signal and China If You're Listening on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.